Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Aaron Powell.
And I'm Trevor Burrus.
Joining us today is Deirdre McCloskey. She's a distinguished professor of economics, history, English, and communications at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And today we're talking about an essay she wrote for an upcoming volume edited by Ben Powell on prospects for libertarianism. The essay is called Manifesto for a New American Liberalism, or How to Be a Humane Libertarian. Welcome back to Free Thoughts.
Yes, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You begin the essay by talking about liberalism 1.0.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, this is a coinage by Dan Klein, an economist friend of mine. And he's making the point, and I'm making the point, that we free countries were once liberal in my sense, and in Dan's sense, and in Tocqueville's sense, and in Adams's sense, and so forth, that it was we were free economies without much in the way of government intervention. And then in both England and the United States, especially the United States, the word liberal was, so to speak, taken over by what I call slow socialists. And they're my friends. I don't think they're evil people, but for about 100 years, the word has meant in the United States larger and larger government.
What is slow socialism as opposed to fast?
Well,
socialism?
Fast socialism would be 1917 and communism,
okay.
or the horror of Venezuela these days. But I was once a Marxist, and then I was a Keynesian, and that's kind of slow socialism. One takes the view that the government is very nice and is very competent, and so we need more of that and less economic freedom.
Is it slow socialism because it has no principled stopping point?
It has no. That's a very good way to express it. I'm going to adopt that way of saying it. I'm going to steal it immediately because that's the point. There's no limit. If the nanny state, as it's often called, thinks you should go to bed at 8 o'clock, then there's soon. Well, you know, every day we get more news of this. In the state of Tennessee, if you want to open a moving company, a furniture moving company, you have to get the permission of the existing movie company and moving companies. So you can imagine how that works out.
Certificates of need.
Certificates. If you want to braid hair, you need a license from the government. And this is crazy.
So, I mean, but what's wrong with fast socialism seems to have a bad track record, but
yeah.
What's wrong with slow socialism? I mean, don't we need these kinds of rules if we're gonna live together in a complex society where all of our actions impact each other? We've got to follow rules, and we've got to have some way to use the government to make sure that society works for everyone, that
that's
it takes
right.
the shape that we want it to.
There you go. That's the standard argument, and I used to use it when I was a kid, Bernie Sanders uses it, and my friends on the left use it all the time, that the more complicated the economy, the more regulations we need. And of course, it's actually kind of the opposite. The more complicated the economy, the more we need to rely on the immensely complicated plans of individuals and trust, not a blind trust, but a certain trust in the market. If the market results in global warming and air pollution, then there's a case for some intelligent piece of government intervention. But in general, we should let the market work. You know, I came here in an Uber taxi, and it's a cheaper and better service. It's being ferociously opposed by every taxi monopoly in the world. In Germany, they've made it illegal. But that's how the economy should work. People, as the English say, they have an expression, having a go. And allowing people to have a go has worked out very well.
I think that Aaron made the way he said his counterargument was something he said, society is shaped the way we want it or something like that.
Yeah.
That seems to be an interesting – you know, people say that. The government can make sure the society is shaped the way we want it. And they kind of gloss over how kind of crazy
– how hard it is to do. I mean, the key word here, and I urge you all to watch it when it happens, is the word designed. Designed to do such and such. It's a lawyer's word. It's not something that a person who actually understands society a little bit would use, because design is very hard to undertake. Look, if you're engaged in a war for survival, then design is really what you want. You want General Grant or General Lee, for that matter, to be focused on the one thing, and then you kind of know what you need to do. But for something as complicated and rich as a advancing economy, an economy in which the poor are getting much better off than they once were, design is so often doesn't work.
The other one is we.
Because the only we have is the government, and this we-ness is a problem. You know, we want to intern the Japanese. We want to invade Iraq. We.
I think also in design in particular, there's a loss of the sense of costs.
Yeah.
Because I mean, so design in design context, like you're designing a new product. You know, every now and then they'll do these things, like a new iPhone comes out and they'll tear it down. Some tech site will tear it down and they'll add up the cost of the components. They'll be like, this phone actually only cost X dollars to make, but they're selling it for 2 or 3X.
Right.
You know, where's all that extra cost? And the cost is that the design process was so expensive and so wasteful. You know, you try it, it doesn't work. You scrap it, you try it again. But we seem to think that design, when government does it, doesn't work that way. The design is just you have like this abstract idea and then you apply it.
That's right. And the key sort of ideology behind the left and behind this slow socialism is that the economy is easy. You can come up with that all the time. People are saying, well, you know, we'll subsidize. We'll subsidize solar panels. That'll be easy. Everyone knows that solar panels made in the United States are the ones we want. And then you lose $500 million, which is what the Solyndra fiasco was all about. And it's, I'm not making out that the Obama administration was terrible at this, but it is that they think, and this is a very deep presumption, especially by people who have never been on a farm or who have never been, weren't raised in a small grocery store where they worked. I find that my students who are raised in small businesses like small farms, they understand economics. They understand there's no free lunch. They understand the price system. Whereas if you grow up like I did as the child of an academic, actually a professor, you don't know what your father does. You know that your mother's a central planner in the household, and you think, gee, let's make this national. Why not central planning for 324 million people in the United States?
It definitely seems but that's a really good way of describing Paul Krugman, for example,
exactly.
That the economy is easy. Now, what about, we're talking about the socialists on the left, the so-called liberals. What about conservatives? Are they an issue?
There sure is. My view is that conservatives, we as free market advocates, as Catoites, we ought to be trying to occupy the middle. This thing that just happened in France with Macron. By the way, I was at a dinner party in Paris a couple of months ago before the election, and I pointed out to the assembled group that Macron in ancient Greek means big deal. And it is a big deal that he's occupied the middle with real liberalism. That is, freedom for people so far as social matters are concerned, transgendered people or people from Morocco and so forth on the one hand, and fiscal responsibility on the other. So taking the best of the Democrats and the Republicans, so to speak, in France, the conservatives and the socialists. So I think there's a middle ground that free market advocates should be assuming. We should be taking it. We are the radicals, as we once were, of course. We are the ones who can stand between these two. But, you know, look, you know someone's a conservative if, unlike me, they think that the 1960s was the beginning of the rut. If they say, oh, the women came out of the kitchen and started messing around with flying airplanes and so on, and those damn blacks or darn blacks or however you want to express it, they started to get uppity and these queers, they got out of the closet, and these colonial people, once they had it all well organized in the British and French and empires, and now they've gotten around. Oh, I hate it. And you know, a progressive in a deep sense is someone who believes the 1960s was the beginning of the modern era of freedom, of liberation. And we have to get across somehow to our audience and beyond our audience that institutions like Cato and the Charles Koch Institute and others are – their view of the 60s is precisely that it was the beginning of true freedom.
But there's a view the progressives, and they look back on the 60s, and then they look at the Great Society laws.
Yeah. That's the other set. That's the slow socialist coming. Yeah, you're
sure.
Right.
So
about
what
that.
Do we say? So what they say is like, look, that the two things go hand in hand.
Mm-hmm.
That we stopped oppressing people,
we stopped
marginalizing people, and we brought them into society. But that part of what that means is then taking care of each other,
being part
of the society. So what do we in that radical center?
I'm an Abrahamic socialist, Jewish.
You mean Abraham, like the Abraham?
The Abraham, Abraham, the named Abram. Christian Muslim. I'm an Anglican. I'm an Episcopalian. And I believe that we do have a responsibility to the poor. But our responsibility is to give them opportunity, to make sure they're not serfs of the public schools, that they're look, I come from Chicago, and the south and west sides of Chicago are really in terrible shape. That doesn't mean there's not a vital and large black middle class, but there's also a not so vital and very poor black underclass. The south and west sides of Chicago ought to be hives of industrial activity. They were in the 19th and early 20th century. There was no problem getting a job in the 1920s in Chicago. But we put obstacles in the way. We have interventions in the wage bargain, so-called protections of various kinds, such as the minimum wage, that make it impossible for a person who's not worth $12 an hour or $15 or $10 or whatever it is to be hired by anyone. And then we have zoning, which makes it impossible to open a factory on the west side of Chicago, as you so could. And if you didn't think that was enough to stop enterprise, we have this war on drugs, which turns the south and west parts of the south and west side into free fire zones. And this is very bad for the poor. And unfortunately, lots of these things are outgrowths of this regulatory impulse, longstanding. As you say, it starts with American progressivism 100 years ago, and then it's ramped up in the 30s, and then especially, as you pointed out, in the Great Society programs of the 60s. And we ought to step back. We ought to have you could call them by various names. We ought to have enterprise zones, for example.
There's a new word that is
being used a lot, and it makes me cringe whenever I see it used. And since it's liberalism, and now we're neoliberalism, and I feel like anytime anyone uses that word, they're derogatory. They're saying
it's
something
a term
bad.
Of contempt. I was at a small conference at my university at UIC. With my colleagues, I'm a professor of English and history as well as economics, and they were mainly from English and history, and they had brought this Marxoid from New York, a smart guy who talked about economic history in the United States since the war. And, you know, some of his points were good and some of them weren't so good, and I stood up and very politely said, you know, maybe you should change such and such in your argument, and I'm an economic historian. I'm not an unknown figure in this. And he said, here's what happened. He said, I see that you're a neoliberal, and sat down. That was his reply. And what I found very distressing is my colleagues didn't say, well, you know, come on. Deirdre McCluskey might have a little standing to talk a tiny bit about economic history. Maybe you better actually answer her. But they didn't do it.
You'd mentioned that you were at one time a Marxist and moved through this progression.
I was kind of a Joan Baez Marxist.
Okay.
So you were just in it for the folk music.
Tiny bit simple-minded,
How did you change your mind?
Well, very slowly. I mean, I was at Harvard College. You know, Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn and I in, say, 1960, we're about the same age, we all had the same opinion. Capitalism is the problem. Let's have a revolution. The problem is that those two guys haven't changed their opinion. I've changed my opinion on lots of things, including my gender. But I then became a Keynesian because that was what was on offer in the economics department. I wanted to help the poor, so I became an economist. And then I became a kind of social engineer. We were going to come down to Washington. We was at Harvard in graduate school, and we were going to fine-tune the economy, you know. And then I started to apply economics to economic history, and I realized that these tools, these basic tools of economics, supply and demand curves and so on, make a lot of sense and are useful for history. Then I got a job at the University of Chicago in 1968. I taught there for 12 years. And then in 1974, Robert Nozick's book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, sort of solidified it for me. And then I continued to drift somewhat more slowly in the next couple, three, four decades. And now I describe myself, as I said, as a Christian real liberal and as a kind of Austrian economist much more than I was. And I speak in terms of humanomics. I'm trying to combine the humanities and the social sciences in a serious way. So I've, you know, my hero, my heroine is Mae West, who was brilliant. She was a comedian in the movies in the 30s. And she said, I was Snow White, but I drifted. Come up and see me sometime. I am in favor of the institution of marriage, but I'm not ready for an institution.
So do you think – would you drift all the way to anarchism?
No. In fact, my first politics was anarchism, oddly enough. At the Carnegie Library in Wakefield, Massachusetts, built by Andrew Carnegie, I found Prince Kropotkin's book, Mutual Aid, when I was about 15 years old, and it blew me away. He was a prince of the Russian Empire and an anarchist, unfortunately a left anarchist. So he believed the problem was the state. I still agree with him there. And then the other problem is ownership and capitalism. And that's where I parted slowly. I have a nostalgic affection for anarchists.
When we talk about taking away some of these controls that the government controls, protections that the government has put on us over the last century.
So-called protection.
It seems to me that aside from people's objections, you know, our food is going to be polluted, our air is going to be polluted, people are going to be – but the big one that is really important now for the conversation is inequality.
It keeps changing what is important.
True.
Now it's inequality.
Now it's inequality and the corporations
– The international corporations.
What do we say about inequality?
Well, about the international corporations, we say, so dare you as a slow socialist want to make – a corporation called the federal government larger and stronger and completely monopolistic. That's one way to answer them. These are not knockdown arguments. The fact is that real inequality has fallen. In the first place, worldwide, it's fallen with the economic growth in China and India and other some other places. But even inside countries like the United States, in substance, it's declined. Now it's true that Lilian Betancourt, the heiress to the L'Oreal fortune, the richest woman in the world, has a bunch of stupid diamonds in her jewelry box that she never wears, and chateaux she doesn't ever visit, and yachts she doesn't go on because she gets seasick, and so forth. She's got all these toys, but basic goods are much more equally spread than they were in, say, 1800 or 1900 or 1960. Things have improved for poor people. When I was young, poor people, there were actually people starving in the United States. There were actually people grossly malnourished. Now they're everyone, including me, are overnourished. There was no air conditioning. Take that as a simple case in point. There were horrible heat waves in Chicago and Washington and so forth that resulted in hundreds and hundreds of deaths. And then air conditioning first came to movie theaters, and then my parents got an air conditioner in their bedroom in 1956. And now it's commonplace.
It's interesting. There's also no rich man's air conditioning. There's no rich man's super high level air. There's also no rich man's iPhone, which I think is super interesting.
Exactly. I don't want to say everyone because, look, there are poor people. I supported two homeless people in my home for 4.5 years in my own home. And I still tithe to my Episcopal church, and they're a very efficient charity, and they do very good work. So I'm as I told you, I'm a bleeding heart libertarian. I want the poor to be better off. But as far as this inequality thing is concerned, aside from envy about the diamonds, which is silly. I mean, envy is insatiable. What's the real problem here? And there's not a problem. There's not a serious problem. The poor are much better off than they were 50 years ago or 30 years ago. And I want that to continue. And the main way for it to continue is to have economic growth.
So when people complain about inequality and systemic inequality and growing inequality, I really get the sense that it's not so much that there's rich people with baubles that poor people don't have, but that they almost adopt like a – take a line out of Michael Walzer's Spheres of Justice and say that the issue is not that there's – within the sphere of money, some people have a lot more than others, but that having a lot more bleeds into other spheres. And so what it turns into is disparities in power, that the rich can get their way and the poor can't, or the rich can exploit the poor and the poor can't do anything about it. And the wealth disparity is both a cause and a symptom of that, but it's not itself the real problem.
Yeah. Of all the communitarians, Mike is the most deep. Sandel, for example, at Harvard is not deep. He's an inch deep. And yes, there is a danger there. But as Mike has said in print, he was asked, Is capitalism corrupting? There is a book that asks that. Is the market corrupting? And he said, yeah, it is. And then he said, and so are all the other alternatives. The socialist or the populace, let's say, who makes crazy promises. I was talking to the Uber driver about it this week as I came over this morning. That's corruption too. And then it ends up that his family is better off, as in the case of Trump. So, I think that's a very wise remark. And from an Abrahamic and Christian perspective, I have no trouble with that. That's original sin, dears. Power tends to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So we need to make sure that we need to help market economies to be competitive and to free entry, and you have to break apart monopolies like the doctors,
the
plumbers.
AMA.
I mean the AMA, yeah. American Medical Association, and so. And when have the rich not been the rulers? Gabriel Kolko, a new left historian back in the 60s, wrote about the ICC, the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was to leash the railways and prevent them from exploiting the farmers. And in fact, they did the opposite. They got captured, as Kolko documented, very quickly by the railways. Instead of reducing fares, they raised fares. And then they got to regulate trucking as well. So it was and we at the University of Chicago Economics Department were delighted at Kolko. So here's a man of the left. We're supposed to be on the right. I don't think we really were, but supposed to be on the right. And he and we were agreeing. Namely, we called it the golden rule. Those who have the gold rule, and we hated it as much as Kolko and the new left did.
Does liberalism, if it's working well in the sense of growing betterment, as you trade tested betterment,
yeah.
Does it contain the seeds of its own demise in the sense by producing enough wealth that people start wanting to take it? Because it seems if everyone's toiling in the field,
yeah.
A, you're not taking things for granted, and I think
yeah.
people start to take wealth for granted in a
yeah.
affluent liberal society.
Yeah.
And B, you understand that everyone else is also working in the field.
Yeah.
But then when you start seeing, oh, there's a hedge fund manager
yeah, yeah.
who does
he's,
an important
he's working in the field,
thing.
But he's behind the hedge.
He's behind the hedge. Yeah. Touche. So, and you say, well, I don't see what he's doing now. He's,
yeah,
he's
yeah.
managing that hedge, and he's making
yeah,
a
yeah.
lot of money.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so now we can just take away.
Yeah, that's right. And but this, as you know, is an old theme in the study of modern society. Marx said that capitalism would raise its own grave diggers, and lots of people have made this point.
Schumpeter
did. Schumpeter did, and what's his name? The sociologist did. And I just don't think it's inevitable. I think we can rage against the dying of the light. But it is a problem. It's this problem that we grow up in socialist societies. They're called families. And so every generation has to be taught again, especially now. We as you said, we grow up in families that are very far from production. If you grow up on a farm or in a small business, you kind of understand there's no such thing as a free lunch. You got to work to get more medical care. You can't just raise the minimum wage to $100 an hour and we'll all be better off. And you know what prices do. You kind of understand the economy. I find my students who come from farms and small businesses catch on to economics much faster than I did. And there are a lot more eyes in the economy now than there were when I graduated from college in 64, and a ton more than there were in 1900. One-third of the American population was on farms in 1900.
So people who just sort of don't understand their academics or their lawyer fathers
things
like that.
That's right. And it's not just the pointy-head intellectuals. If your dad and mom goes off to the office and you have no idea what it means or what it Or even if you go visit the office, and that's nice, take your daughter to work day, you still don't understand what mom is doing. She's talking on the phone a lot, and you don't know what that's all about and what it has to do with the meat that comes to you in a nice cellophane package in the store, and you think that's where meat comes from. Where does meat come from? It comes from the supermarket.
On the question of poor and the role of government in their lives, so on the on the left, they say we need to effectively financially help the poor.
Yeah.
Because
and I'm actually in favor of that in some circumstances, a hand up, a handout,
sure.
In the right circumstance.
But you write in the essay that what we really need to do is kind of get out of their way,
yeah.
is trust them to
much more.
Know what's right for them. But
yeah.
So on this is an argument that gets traditionally made more on the right, is that do the poor know what's best for them? Aren't there people, classes of people, individuals who really do need their lives
yeah.
guided by someone who knows better? And I'm thinking, so we saw the 2016 election to some extent was a whole bunch of people who were not the elites fed up with elites telling them what to do or telling them what they couldn't do. And
yeah.
So lashing out and saying, no, we know what's best.
Yeah,
but then their things that they picked as the we know what's best would be catastrophic, not just for the elites, but for themselves.
Yeah.
Can we kind of trust them to run their own lives?
Well, you know, that's the, as you said, that's the conservative line. It's also the left wing line. And we people from Cato and so forth, we think that there's a third possibility, we don't believe in compulsion. We don't believe in violence. We're in favor of persuasion, of sweet talk, as I call it. And we believe that people should be left alone on the whole. You know, so it was said that these people can't take care of themselves, about women, about blacks, about colonial people. In Holland, where I've lived for a number of years, they used to say at the height of the Dutch Empire, mainly what's now Indonesia, they said this would be around 1900. The standard line was, well, we're no longer extracting tremendous amounts from Indonesia, although in some ways they still were. We're their guardians. And then you'd say, well, how long is that going to go on? Oh, about 200 years, said the Dutch. The well-meaning Dutch, the left, at least of the kind of imperialists, viewed it this way. So I just think this business of people not taking care of themselves is not good. The Protestant Reformation was mainly significant for the making of the modern world, not the way Max Weber said it was, by changing people's psychology and making them more afraid they weren't going to get into heaven or something. But it's mainly church governance. Instead of the priest saying, we'll take care of this, you don't need to bother, it was the priesthood of all believers, especially on the radical side of the Reformation.
You write about some you say it a little obliquely, sometimes directly, but you say sometimes libertarians are taking bad rhetorical tactics, and I think
they
you
are.
Kind of say that sometimes they actually champion selfishness and
they
of
do.
A sort that is
this
not
this is the Ayn Rand problem.
The Ayn Rand problem.
That's how I think of it.
So what sort of libertarians are you finding out there, and what are the kind of mistakes are they making out of
that? They got to stop saying "screw you, I'm rich." That's what the country club says, and that's just not an intelligent way of talking, because we don't. At least I, and I think it's true of both of you, we don't want to disdain the poor. We want them to do well, and we want them to flourish in a free society, the kind of society that can be as Langston used, the great African-American poet said, an America that can be and should be. And it's a good, sensible, practical vision. It can be done. And if we keep sneering at the poor this way, that's not a good move. What we should be saying, what Cato should have emblazoned on its front, the building is, we want to help the poor. Every speech we give, every article we write, we think that this regulation or that in the federal government is a bad thing because it hurts the poor. And that should be our focus. And then we can take the middle, as Emmanuel Macron, we hope, we pray, in, of all places, France. Henry Kissinger once joked, France is the only successful communist country because it's been centralized for four centuries. They've been working on it.
You also write that you think that in our rules for rhetoric, you think that we need to make sure that we talk about, criticize conservatives just as much as we do
I think we need – what liberals, real liberals or bleeding heart liberals or whatever wanted should be doing is getting away from being placed on this one spectrum on the right. Because when I announce that I'm a libertarian, people say, "Oh, you're a conservative." I say, "No, I'm not." Hayek's essay, Friedrich Hayek's essay at the end of the Constitution of Liberty, is a quite good essay. Why I am not a conservative, and we ought to keep on. As he points out, it's quite interesting. He's got a good way of formulating it. He says that conservatives have great faith in evolution up to the present. That all the things that evolved, all the English Constitution, everything, it's wonderful, it's wonderful. It evolved. That's a good thing. But they're terrified of future evolution. And that's where Hayek disagrees with them.
Well, it seems to me sometimes conservatives are socially planning. They're socially planning where the left is economically planning. If they're trying to,
That's right. Free on the social side, free on the economic side. We're the party of freedom. We're the real radicals, and we can harness the imagination of the young in a way that these old farts, if you'll pardon the expression, can't.
I once did a debate on marriage for gay marriage against a conservative, and I just started talking about divorce law, which conservatives have been playing with forever, resisting no-fault divorce and things like this. And really, that's just if you're fixing the rules of divorce, you're just price fixing the exit cost of marriage.
Of course you
in
are.
In a social planning problem that's just as a perversion of Hayekian principles as any other sort of price fixing.
I express it that the conservatives want to get into our bedrooms and the slow socialists want to get into our businesses. And I think they should lay off both of them.
Are we, I guess, so far as direction goes, headed in the right way? I was struck, I think yesterday, that I saw that a survey of voters in 2016 came out that put them on the standard like economic social liberty quadrant chart and then had dots for where they voted, who they voted, Trump or Hillary, and then yellow for other, and there weren't a lot of yellows.
Yeah.
And what was really striking was first, the unsurprising thing that in the maximal freedom on both, there were almost no voters.
Yeah.
But that this kind of standard line that the conservatives are for economic freedom but not for social freedom, and then the progressives are for social freedom but not for economic freedom, was not borne out by this data at all.
Oh, really?
That in fact what you saw was that the conservatives were – so the Trump voters, all the red dots, were clustered, yes, very low on social freedom.
Right.
But also were very much – like they were basically in the middle on economic freedom.
Yeah, yeah.
Like they've been they leaned against economic freedom.
Yeah, yeah.
Then the liberals were in
not
a similar
the
progressives were in a similar boat, that they didn't care about economic freedom, but their social freedom wasn't terribly high either. And that seems to be, I mean, anecdotally, with the rise of the waves of protests on campus, and the economic populism on the right, are we drifting? You know, because it used to be like, well, at least each group was kind of half good.
Yeah.
But now it feels like the groups are – there's no good.
That's an interesting observation, and it sounds – it kind of accords with what I can see.
Well, Brian Kaplan calls it the median voter is a national socialist.
Yeah. Yeah, the median voter is a national socialist. There were three ideas that the intellectuals, or I call them the clerisy, have had in the last three centuries. One was very good. It was the 18th century idea from Voltaire to Mary Wollstonecraft of liberalism, of freedom. The other two were nationalism and socialism. They were invented in the 19th century, and they were terrible ideas. And then if you like them, you ought to try national socialism, which, as Brian says,
double your pleasure, double your fun. Yeah,
that's right. Double your pleasure, double your fun, or quadruple your fun. So, well, I don't know. I think that the demonstration effect of successful liberalism, say in India or China, so far as economic freedom is concerned, is pretty powerful. You know, we can screw it up. We did in August of 1914, and the European Civil War began, which ended kind of in 1989. So that's why we need to have programs like this. We need to talk up economic freedom and social freedom and try to get people to move off of this – I agree, this kind of fascist consensus that they have. So let's, you know, I'm optimistic about how fast culture can change, how fast political culture can change. The United States in the First World War was an isolationist power, didn't think it was a good idea to intervene, and then within months, with a very skillful guy in charge of propaganda for the government, it switched. And we were forbidding people to give sermons in German, just like
– or to teach their kids German.
Or to teach their kids German, or to speak German in public. And so these things move very fast. And gay rights, for example, didn't move at all, and then woof, changed. And so if we keep at it, I mean, we, the kind of elite clerisy, can only do a little bit. As they say in country music, the rubber meets the road with the popular culture, with the movies, country music, indeed, with rock music, and you know, it's not so much the New York Times, which foretells the future, but the New York Post, and we've got to get those people going in the right direction. I've seen a couple of movies in the last couple of years which encourage me. Joy. About Joy Mangano, the inventor of the self-squeezing mop, which was a pro-capitalism movie. And the other one was this one about McDonald's with
the founder.
Yeah, the founder is an excellent movie. I didn't quite see the end of it, so I'm not sure if it was entirely pro-capitalist, but it was a lot better than the Wall Street movies. So we got to keep at it.
It seems that we also can be optimistic about things like Uber or Airbnb.
Absolutely.
Because I always say that there's a big gap between our position papers, our op-eds, listening to Free Thoughts, and because a lot of people just don't consume any of that. But if they ride Uber and they suddenly demand – They say,
that's
don't
right.
take away my Uber. Don't
right.
do
well,
taxi cab cartel. There's a taxi cab cartel. They just learned. You know, they didn't even know before.
They didn't even know it existed.
And they want
now
Uber
they know
now.
It, and it's, by the way, it's spreading all these lies about Uber. It's clear that that's the source. Speaking of the – it's the sort of the deep state of the taxi monopolies. But I heard a very interesting talk by an entrepreneur in the computer industry. In fact, I have a friend in the computer industry too, and he says the same thing, that computer stuff is ahead of the regulators. Now, power generation, medicine is not ahead of the regulators. It's the regulators have been sitting on that like some giant toad for a century. But the computer people are so creative and are making up stuff every day, new apps, new this, new that. And Washington hasn't quite figured out, or Springfield for that matter, hasn't figured out how to stop it. And so maybe there's some optimism on that side of the economy. The problem is in these traditional industries, the regulation is so heavy. That's my only positive hope for the Trump administration, if it lasts very long, is that it will deregulate. Now we'll see if he can actually do anything at all.
Yeah, it sounds like you're making our colleague Jason Kuznicki published a book about the history, the concept of the state, and he makes what I think he refers to in the book as a state in the gaps argument, riffing off of the God in the gaps argument.
Yeah.
That you know the state is basically when we don't know how to solve something. We just kind of fill that in with
yeah,
the
but
state.
That was dangerous in theology.
Sure,
I know something about that.
So it sounds like
dangerous in politics too.
Yes,
so he agrees.
Yes, so what we're saying with the technology, I think then is that the one of the values that it has is it kind of shrinks those gaps.
Yeah, that's
like
right.
Those areas that we didn't think like you can't do this thing without the government because the technology moves so fast because you can deploy an app so quickly, whereas you can't deploy like a new power system or a new cancer drug quickly.
Yeah, that's right.
People can latch on and can see it in their own lives.
And I just wrote an essay available on my website about economics. I'm going to be presenting it to the History of Economics Society in a couple of days in Toronto. And I point out that since 1848, the way academic economists have made their reputation is by pointing out imperfections, one after another. Ignorant consumers who don't know that they shouldn't consume alcohol, say, or monopolies. In the 1890s, that was the big talk. Externalities and economies of scale in the 1920s, the tendency to endless unemployment in the 30s, bad investment in the 40s, informational asymmetries. My friend George Akerlof got a Nobel Prize for that, and Joe Stiglitz is also a nice guy, but he's a fool in so many ways. And I point out in this essay that none of these have been shown to be important. Yet at the same time that economists have been listing, I chronicled, hear this, 105 imperfections.
Did you just go to Samuelson's book for every year?
Exactly.
For every edition?
I was educated in Samuelson's book. By the way, he was my mother's longtime mixed doubles partner, in case you care.
Now that is the best piece of random trivia I've ever heard.
That's right. Paul in the book spends, you know, 5 minutes on supply and demand, and then he spends the rest of the book talking about how it doesn't work. Monopolistic competition. I was a student of Edward Chamberlain at Harvard in the 60s, and that was his thing. And on and on, and now inequality, the alleged inequality, which I don't think is correct. I did a long review of Piketty's book. Now, meanwhile, this terribly imperfect capitalism, exchange-tested betterment, increased the real income of the average worker by a factor of 30. That's 3,000% since 1800 in most countries, a little since the United States in 1800 was already one of the richest countries in the world, a little less for us, but say a factor of 2,000%. What? This imperfection, and that's the problem. That's the scientific problem. They haven't – when a physicist proposes an amendment of Newton's laws, he, namely Einstein, tells how big it's going to be. Says, look, for things moving at close to the speed of light, such and such will be true. And light itself will bend around the sun to this extent. And economists never do it. They say, oh, woe is me. There's monopoly. We've got to bring the government in. Woe is me. There's informational asymmetry. You've got to bring the government in. Woe is me. People don't have enough education. We've got to bring the government in. That's funny. Always the solution is to bring the government in to fill the gaps.
Thanks for listening. This episode of Free Thoughts was produced by Tess Terrible and Evan Banks. To learn more, visit us at www.libertarianism.org.